Chapter 20. Great and terrible was the year of our Lord 1918, but the year 1919 was still more terrible. On the night of the 2nd of February, at the entrance to the chain bridge across the River Dnieper, two men were dragging someone across the snow in a black, torn overcoat, his blood-stained face covered in bruises. Beside them ran a Cossack sergeant, hitting him over the head with a ramrod. At every blow, the blood-stained man's head jerked back, but he had stopped yelling and was now simply moaning. As the ramrod lashed with considerable force into the torn overcoat, the man would respond to every blow with an "Uff! Ah!"
"You Yiddish bastard!"
the sergeant yelled, incensed with fury.
"You're going to be taken to those stacks and shot! I'll teach you to skulk about the place! I'll teach you! What were you doing hiding behind those stacks, you spy?"
But the blood-stained man did not answer the enraged sergeant. Then the sergeant ran a little way in front, and the two others jumped aside to avoid the swish of the descending, glittering rod. Without calculating the strength of the blow, the sergeant smashed the rod into the man's head with the force of a lightning bolt. Something cracked, and this time there was no response from the man. His head lolled back, and thrusting out one arm, he slumped over from his knees to one side, and with a wide sweep, he flung his other arm back, as if he wanted to scoop up as much as possible of the trampled and dung-covered ground around him. His fingers formed into a crook, and he started scrabbling at the dirty snow. Then he just lay there in a dark puddle, twitching several times, and finally went still. Above the victim at the entrance to the bridge, an electric lamp hissed, and all around him scuttled the frightened shadows of Cossacks with their tasseled caps. Above was the black vault of the sky, shining with a myriad of twinkling stars. And at the very moment that the man lying on the ground died, the star of Mars in the frozen heights above the outskirts of the city suddenly exploded with a deafening roar, spattering fire. And following the star, the black distances on the far bank of the Dnieper, leading to far-off Moscow, also erupted in a prolonged, heavy crash of thunder. And then a second star exploded, but this time lower down, right above the roofs of the houses buried under the snow. And immediately, the blue Heidemack division set off from the bridge and trotted into the city, continuing through the city and out of sight forever. Behind them raced the frozen horses of Kozir Lyeshka's unit like a pack of wolves, followed by a bouncing field kitchen. Then the entrance to the bridge was empty, as if nobody had been there. Only the congealing corpse of the black-coated Jew remained, together with the trampled mounds of snow and the piles of horse dung. And the corpse was the only witness to the fact that Petura had not been just a myth, that he really had been there. Ring, clang, the guitar and the Turk, the metal lamp on Bronaya, girls' plaits, whirling snow, gunshot wounds, wolves howling at nighttime, the frost. Yes, it had all really happened.
"Look, there's Grisha, he's off to work.
But his boots are torn.
He's gone berserk."
But why had it happened? What was it all for? Nobody can tell. But will anyone pay for all the bloodshed? No. No one. The snow will simply thaw. The green Ukrainian grass will spring up and plat the earth. The fresh, lush shoots will sprout, and the heat will shimmer over the fields. But of all that blood, not a trace will remain. Blood is cheap in those dark red fields, and no one will ever pay for it. No one. Since the early evening, the tiles on the Sardam stove had glowed with heat, and all the stoves had been kept warm until deep into the night. All the inscriptions on the shipwright of Sardam had been washed off, except for the remains of one.
"Len, have a ticket for Aid."
The house on St. Alexei's Hill, The house, crowned by its general's cap of snow, had long since been wrapped in a warm sleep. Dreams flitted among the curtains and flickered in the shadows. Outside, the frozen night became more and more dominant as it floated over the earth. The stars danced, shrinking and expanding, and especially high in the sky was the red five-pointed star of Mars. Alexei slept in his bedroom, his dream hovering above him like an indistinct painting. The hallway floated by, swaying as it went, and the Emperor Alexander I was setting light to the battalion papers in the stove. Yulia went by, beckoning to him and laughing. Shadows flitted past, and people shouted, "Grab him! Grab him!" There were people firing at him soundlessly, and he was trying to run away from them, but his feet stuck to the pavement on Maloprovalnaya Street, and Alexei died in his sleep. He woke up with a groan and heard Mishlaevsky snoring in the sitting room, and the gentle whistle of Karas's and Lariosik's breathing from the library. Becoming fully awake, he wiped the sweat from his brow, smiling to himself as he reached out for his watch. It said 3 o'clock. They must have gone by now. Petura, too, and he'll never come back. And then he fell asleep again. The night blossomed as it moved towards morning. The house slept on, buried under its shaggy mantle of snow. Tossing and turning, Vasilisa slept in the cold sheets, warming them with his emaciated body. He was having an absurd, circular dream. In the dream, it was as if there hadn't been any revolution at all. It had all been nonsensical rubbish. A vague, indeterminate feeling of happiness washed over him. And then, in his dream, it was summer, and he had just bought an allotment in which vegetables sprang up instantaneously. The beds were full of cheerful little green shoots, through which cucumbers peeked out like little figs. Vasilisa stood there in a pair of canvas trousers, scratching his stomach and watching the enchanting sunset. Then he dreamt of his globe-shaped clock that had been stolen from him. He wanted to feel sad because of the clock, but the sun was shining so pleasantly that he was unable to feel sad. And then, at this precise moment when everything was so pleasant, several round pink piglets flew into the allotment and immediately started rooting up the vegetable beds with their little round snouts. The earth spewed up into the air like fountains. Vasilisa picked up a stick from the ground and prepared to chase the piglets away, but they suddenly turned into fearsome-looking animals with sharp fangs. They rushed towards him, jumping several feet into the air as they did so, because they had springs inside them. Vasilisa howled with terror in his sleep. Then a huge black doorpost crashed down on the piglets, and they disappeared into the ground. And Vasilisa emerged from his dream to find himself in his damp, dark bedroom. The night continued to blossom. The spirit of sleep flew on over the city like some nebulous white bird, passing by the cross of St. Vladimir until it reached the other side of the river Dnieper, where, at the very dead of night, it floated along the railway track. When it reached Danica, it stopped and began hovering above the station. On track number 3, an armored train stood waiting. The grey gun platforms were armor-plated, right down to the wheels. The locomotive loomed up into the sky in a dark mass of multifaceted metal, red-hot fire spilling out from its belly onto the rails, so that from the side it looked as if its womb was overflowing with incandescent coals. It was quietly and ominously hissing away to itself. Something was oozing from its sides, and its blunt snout was silently pointed at the forests lying along the bank of the Dnieper. On the last gun platform, a broad muzzle wrapped in a cover pointed up into the blue-black sky, aimed directly at the Midnight Cross, some 8 miles away. The station was frozen in horror. It moved into the darkness head-on, and it shone with the eyes of little yellow lights still reeling from the thunder of the evening's events. Despite the late hour, its platforms were bustling with people. There were 3 bright lights showing in the small yellow telegraph building, and through the windows the constant clatter of telegraph machines could be heard. Despite the biting frost, the figures of people wrapped up in fur coats down to their knees, in greatcoats and black jackets, ran up and down the platform. On a sidetrack behind the armored train, a troop train waited patiently, its carriage doors slamming with a resounding echo. By the locomotive of the armored train and the metal sides of the first armored car, a man in a long greatcoat, tattered felt boots, and a sharp-pointed domed hat was patrolling back and forth like a pendulum. He held his rifle in his hands tenderly, as if he were a tired mother cradling a baby. In the dim lamplight, the sharp black outline of a soundless bayonet kept pace with him as he moved up and down between the rails. The man was extremely tired and frozen to the bone. The wooden fingers of his blue, cold hands dug around in vain, seeking shelter in the torn sleeves of his coat. His eyes stared out from under snow-covered eyelashes and the ragged white fringe of his hood framing his mouth encrusted with frost. His languorous, light blue eyes were glazed with suffering and lack of sleep. The man walked up and down methodically, his bayonet lowered, thinking only about one thing: how soon his hour of frozen torture could end, and he would be able to leave this brutal cold behind and go inside, into the heavenly warmth of the carriage and its hissing pipes, and into the crowded space of his compartment, where he could flop onto his narrow bunk and sprawl out, sticking to it like glue. Up and down the man's shadow moved, from the fiery glow of the armored locomotive belly to the dark side of the first armored car, until he reached the black sign saying, "Armored Train Proletarian." Now increasing in size, now hunching up like some hideous monster, but always retaining its sharply pointed tip, the shadow carved its way through the snow with its black bayonet. Behind him, the blue lights of the lamps hung in the air. On the platform, there were two blue moons that teased rather than warmed. The man looked everywhere for a fire, but without success. Clenching his teeth and abandoning any hope of ever warming his toes by simply wiggling them around, he fixed his gaze on the stars. The easiest star for him to look at was Mars, shining in the sky above the edge of the city. And as he looked upwards, his eyes encompassing distances of millions and millions of miles, he never for an instant let the vibrant red star out of his sight. It was five-pointed and clearly alive as it expanded and contracted. At times, overcome by exhaustion, the man stopped and lowered the butt of his rifle onto the snowy ground and, within the space of a moment, fell transparently asleep. Yet although he was asleep, the black wall of the armored train and the sounds of the station remained with him as he slept. But they were joined by other sounds, and the vault of the sky expanded into something vast, sparkling and glittering with an abundance of vibrant red stars. His heart instantly flooded with happiness. Then a strange unknown man in chainmail appeared on horseback and floated up towards him in a friendly sort of way. The black armored train was on the verge of disappearing from his dream, it seemed, to be replaced by a village buried deep in snow, the village of Malyachugri. The man was standing on the edge of the village, and the other man, the one on horseback coming towards him, was his fellow villager and neighbor.
"Zhilin?"
the man's brain asked silently, without using his lips. And immediately he heard the grim voice of the guard hammering away inside him with the words, "Sentry, post, you'll freeze to death." With a totally superhuman effort, the man grabbed his rifle, slung it on his arm, and staggered on his way again, struggling through the snow. Back and forth, the vast, glittering, sleepy vault disappeared, and the frozen world was once more clothed in the familiar blue, silky sky, pierced by the black, sinister shape of a gun barrel. Reddish Venus twinkled, and from time to time the star on the man's chest would reflect the light coming from the blue moon of the station lamp. This star was small, and also five-pointed. The spirit of sleep spun uneasily around as it flew along the river Dnieper, passing over the lifeless jetties and dropping down over Podol, where the lights had long since gone out. Everyone was asleep. Only in a three-story stone building on the corner of Valinskaya Street, in the librarian's apartment, a room that was as narrow and as cramped as the cheapest room in the cheapest hotel, the blue-eyed Rusakov sat by a lamp with a humpbacked glass shade. In front of him lay a hefty book in a yellow leather binding. His eyes were moving slowly and solemnly across the lines, "And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged according to their works. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea." The more he read this extraordinary book, the more his mind became like a shining sword, piercing the darkness. Disease and suffering now appeared unimportant to him, lacking all substance. His illness fell away like the scabby bark from a forgotten tree that has been felled in the forest. He saw the blue, bottomless mist of the centuries, the endless corridor of the millennia. And instead of fear, he felt awe and the wisdom of submissiveness. He felt at peace, and it was in this state of peace that he arrived at the words, "Tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away." The dense fog lifted, and Lieutenant Chervinsky appeared to Yelena. His prominent eyes had a knowing smile. "I am a demon," he said, clicking his heels, "but Talberg's not coming back to you, so I'm going to sing to you." And he drew out of his pocket an enormous tinsel star and pinned it onto her left breast. The fog of sleep swirled around him, and through the clouds, his face appeared like that of a brightly painted doll. He started to sing piercingly, not in his normal real-life voice. "We shall live, we shall live, but death will come, and we shall die," sang Nikolka, coming into the room. He had a guitar in his hands, but his neck was covered in blood, and a yellow wreath with little icons hung round his forehead. Yelena's immediate thought was that he was going to die, and she burst out sobbing. Then, in the middle of the night, she woke up, shouting, "Nikolka! Oh, Nikolka!" And she lay there for a long time, sobbing, listening to the murmuring of the night. And the night floated on. And finally, young Pyotr Szczeglov, from the annex next door to the Turbins, had a dream. Pyotr was a little boy, and therefore he was not interested in the Bolsheviks, or Petlura, or the devil, and he dreamt a dream that was as simple and as joyful as the sun itself. He dreamt he was walking along a large green meadow, on which there was a glittering diamond globe, larger than Pyotr. Whenever adults try to run in their dreams, they find that their feet stick to the ground. They groan and thrash about, attempting to free themselves from the swamp-like ground. Children's feet, on the other hand, are skittish and free. Pyotr ran up to the diamond globe and, laughing and catching his breath from happiness, grasped it with both hands. The globe showered Pyotr with sparkling droplets. That was the whole of his dream. He burst out laughing from happiness in the middle of the night. And from somewhere behind the stove, a cricket joined in, chirping happily. Pyotr began to dream other dreams, all of them joyful and simple, and the cricket sang and sang in reply from its hiding place in a crack in the wall, behind the bucket, bringing the sleepy, murmuring family night to life. The final night flowed on. During its second half, the entire blue, heavy vault of the sky, God's curtain cradling the earth, was a mass of stars. So many stars that that it seemed as if in the infinity lying beyond this blue curtain, an all-night mass were being celebrated in front of the royal gates of a cathedral. The lights had been lit on the altar, and they had started shining through the curtain in the form of crosses, clusters, and squares. Above the river Dnieper, and above the sinful, blood-stained and snow-covered earth, loomed the dark, somber mass of the Midnight Cross of St. Vladimir. From a distance, it seemed as if the crosspiece had merged with the vertical and had disappeared, transforming the cross into a sharp, threatening sword. But it is not to be feared. Everything will pass. Suffering, torment, blood, hunger, and plague. The sword will disappear, but the stars will remain when even the shadows of our bodies and of our deeds no longer remain on this earth. There is not a single person who does not know this. Why then do we not wish to direct our gaze towards them? Why? Moscow, 1923-24. Introduction to The White Guard by Roger Cockerell. It is an evening in mid-December. The tiles of the Dutch stove are blazing with heat, and the outside world lies concealed behind cream-colored curtains. On the table with its starched white tablecloth and vase of slightly faded flowers stand plates of food and bottles of vodka. In one corner of the room, there is a piano with an opera score lying open. One of those present, the youngest of the family, the 17-year-old Nikolka, is strumming quietly on a guitar. The others, including Nikolka's brother and sister, Alexei and Yelena, are sitting round the table, engaged in animated conversation. Every so often, a fierce argument breaks out, only to dissolve in banter and laughter. The room is bathed in the pink glow of the lamplight, filtering through the cigarette smoke. Next door, there is a library lined with books and journals in many languages, evidence of a rich cultural heritage. This is Bulgakov's portrayal in his novel The White Guard of the Turbin family at home, seemingly secure in their first-floor apartment and striving to recreate, now that Alexei has returned from military service, the environment of cozy domesticity that they have all known since early childhood. It is an apparently timeless and strangely innocent picture. Yet time and history have caught up with the Turbins, threatening to destroy not only them, but an entire culture and way of life. For at the point the novel opens, a week or so before Christmas in the terrible year of 1918, the world beyond the cream-colored curtains has become fractured, fraught with menace and confusion. The immediate environs are relatively quiet, with only the occasional sledge swishing along the street on which the Turbins live. But the wider city, with its shops, bars, clubs, and schools that are all so familiar to them, stands on the edge of an abyss. The White Guard, written for the most part in the early 1920s, but remaining unpublished in full in Soviet Russia until 1966, is set in Bulgakov's native city, the Ukrainian capital of Kiev. The narrative spans a period of less than 2 months during the exceptionally harsh winter of 1918-19, with the withdrawal of German troops from Kiev after Germany's defeat on the Western Front in November and the consequential abdication of Kaiser Wilhelm II, the situation of the Ukrainian puppet government under its hetman, Pavlo Skoropadsky, has become untenable. Now, in December, the city is under attack by the forces of the Ukrainian nationalist Simon Petliura, resisted only by scattered and disorganized units of officers and cadets, including the Turbin brothers, and a group of their close friends, the White Guard of the title. Everyday life for the city's population has deteriorated, with circumstances suddenly becoming frighteningly arbitrary and fragile. Although their lives are to be profoundly affected by these events, the Turbin family remains at the still center of this whirlpool throughout the novel. Despite their differences in character, behavior, and temperament, the three of them, together with their close circle of friends, are united by their love for pre-revolutionary Russia, the Tsar and autocracy, and by their anti-Ukrainian sentiments embodied in their hatred for Petliura. Their most vitriolic contempt, however, is reserved for the treacherous behavior of the Hetman and the general staff officers, including Yelena Turbin's husband, Sergei Talberg, who abandon their posts and flee to Germany. Meanwhile, waiting in the wings for the opportunity to strike are the grey hordes of the Bolsheviks under Trotsky. The story that Bulgakov tells is a largely authentic reconstruction of these historical events. Many of the details relating to the setting and the characters, furthermore, possess a strongly autobiographical element, an evocation of Bulgakov's own family circumstances. Yet his use throughout of the term the city to refer to Kiev reminds us that the White Guard is primarily neither autobiography nor history, but a visionary novel springing from a highly original and creative imagination. As in his short story The Fatal Eggs, 1925, the last of Bulgakov's prose works to be published during his lifetime, facts jostle with fiction to portray an alternative universe that diverges from historical reality in seemingly random and therefore unsettling ways. The novel's essentially fictional quality is further emphasized by its abundance of literary allusions, both direct and indirect. Among the most resonant and pervasive of these are the allusions to Tolstoy's War and Peace, the two novels sharing a central theme, the contrast between the concerns of the individual and the family on the one hand, and wide-reaching and destructive historical events on the other. The parallel can be extended to include at least some of the characters. Alexei Turbin, for example, has much in common with Tolstoy's equally skeptical and world-weary Prince Andrei Bolkonsky, and his younger brother Nikolka shares a number of attributes with Pyotr Rostov. Both are guileless, impulsive young men, and both idealize war, anticipating a glorious and heroic death in battle. Until, that is, they come face to face with its reality. Additionally, there is more than an echo in the White Guard of Tolstoy's derisive attack on the pomposity and hubris of so-called great men, the generals and politicians who imagine that they are able to shape the course of historical events. In reality, however, they are merely puppets, their decisions shaped by forces of which they are unaware and which they are unable to control. Whereas Tolstoy tells his story rationally and lucidly, Bulgakov's narrative unfolds far less evenly. Episodes of family life intersperse with accounts of military action, punctuated by songs, poems, dreams, fragments of thoughts, swirling rumors, and snatches of conversation, often of uncertain provenance. The novel's first epigraph, a quotation from Alexander Pushkin's historical novel The Captain's Daughter, describing the onset of a disastrous blizzard, plunges us into a world of darkness and elemental chaos, a world in which people's minds become unhinged and the usual social norms governing human behavior no longer operate. Suffering and tragedy are portrayed on both an individual and a grand scale, with scenes depicting barbaric acts of primitive savagery perpetrated by members of Petliura's armed forces and frequently motivated by the crudest kind of anti-Semitism. The second epigraph, taken from the Book of Revelation, anticipates the apocalyptic theme that manifests itself in various ways throughout the work, including references to the Bolshevik leader Trotsky as the Antichrist, with his armies characterized as legions of the devil. Here, Bulgakov's world intersects most closely with that of Dostoevsky. It is not by chance that the book languishing open at the foot of Alexei's bed is Dostoevsky's most apocalyptic novel, The Devils. Despite the undoubted bleakness of much of the White Guard, this is not the whole story. We note that the red, quivering Mars of the opening paragraph is counterbalanced by Venus, the goddess of love. Through the Turbin family, we are made aware of the resilience of the human spirit and of the virtues of loyalty and steadfastness of principle, qualities that are thrown into strong relief when contrasted with the self-serving banalities of their landlord, Vasily Salisevich, skulking with his wife Vanda in the apartment immediately below the Turbins. Although, with the arrival of the Bolsheviks in the city at the end of the novel, the Turbins' eventual fate remains as uncertain as ever, one of the final scenes shows them at home together, laughing and singing. And in the penultimate paragraph, we see young Petya Szczeglov from the neighboring family, uninterested, we are told, in the Bolsheviks or Petliura or the devil, and dreaming he is walking across a large green meadow towards a glittering diamond globe that showers him with coloured lights when he reaches it. He bursts out laughing from happiness. In the light of Father Alexander's injunction to Alexei that despair is forbidden, such scenes acquire a particular significance. But the novel's clearly religious dimension is not confined to the need for optimism. Every so often, the veil of fog and despair lifts to reveal a providential and mysteriously interconnected universe in which the course of people's lives can be shaped by the apparently miraculous rather than the logic of brutal reality. Nikolka somehow manages to escape from an impossible situation. Alexei is rescued, quite out of the blue, by a total stranger who unselfishly acts to help save his life, and he is later resurrected from the dead through, we are led to believe, the intercession of Yelena with her impassioned prayer to the Virgin Mary. Both brothers are linked, in circumstances that transcend the merely coincidental, by the labyrinth of houses and the white, fairy-tale terraced garden on Maloprovalnaya Street. It is here that Alexei finds Yulia, and that Nikolka meets the sister of his idol, the heroic Colonel Nytours, whose horrific death he has witnessed, and whose body he has helped to bury. There is an unexpected final twist. Bulgakov directs his reader's attention away from purely earthbound concerns, away even from the city, with its abundance of beautiful parks and gardens, and the mighty river Dnieper, overlooked by the towering statue of St. Vladimir and its gigantic illuminated cross. The novel concludes as it began, with an image of the night sky. Since, as Bulgakov assures us, nothing will remain of value other than the stars, why then do we stubbornly continue to ignore their existence? This final paragraph is no mere rhetorical flourish, for it forces us to consider an aspect of the novel that has been present throughout. Bulgakov's implied criticism of the blinkered lives that the Turbins lead. How far, however, is such criticism counterbalanced by Bulgakov's sympathy for a family and a way of life that was so close to his own heart? As in the conclusion to Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, in which there is a similar tension between conflicting emotions, we cannot be certain on which side Bulgakov intended to tip the scales. Whatever we may decide, the fact remains, if people choose to live behind cream-coloured curtains, they may be able, at least for the time being, to shut themselves away from the outside world, but they will certainly deny themselves the opportunity to see the stars.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.